Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Jeannie Sternberg, appearing on behalf of the appellant Tyquan Cox. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm going to focus my remarks today on counsel's deficient representation during the penalty phase and hope to have some time to discuss the shackling of Mr. Cox. As part of the penalty phase deficiencies, I plan to cover counsel's failure to ever understand that Mr. Cox had a meritorious legal defense to the intent requirement of the special circumstance, one that was strongly endorsed by the California Supreme Court in the co-defendant's case, and also to touch a little bit in the penalty phase on counsel's very tardy realization that Mr. Cox was the aider and abettor, because these errors of law and fact impacted counsel's penalty phase investigation and presentation of this theme. Counsel never explained the real significance of the fact that Mr. Cox was the aider and abettor on his culpability. With respect to the penalty phase, Mr. Cox's case does look a little different than others that have come before the court.
You know, the penalty phase, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. So you might be better off just talking about the I don't mean the penalty phase. I'm talking about the guilt phase.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor, I am. But the aiding and abetting issue was a centerpiece of counsel's penalty phase. It is true that counsel did some investigation into penalty phase issues. They interviewed witnesses and they obtained records. It is also true that counsel put on some witnesses. Counsel also retained experts in this case, and two of the experts, the psychologist Michael Maloney and the gang expert Fred Williams, figure prominently in counsel's deficiencies. So given what counsel did, the natural and critical questions that are before the court are, first, are these differences from other cases constitutionally significant on the questions of counsel's deficient performance and prejudice? Second, was counsel's limited investigation reasonable? And third, did counsel investigation enable them to make informed decisions both on how best to represent their client and how to advise their client?
Counsel, in analyzing these issues, is this an AEDPA case or a pre-AEDPA case?
This is a pre-AEDPA case, Your Honor.
It seems that both sides and the district court judge all agreed it was a pre-AEDPA case?
Yes, they did. On this issue, it was.
Is that because the Third Amendment complaint related back to the first one?
There were several. There were two pre-AEDPA petitions filed, one in 1992 and one in January of 1996. And this issue, all of the certified issues actually were fully presented in the very first petition, and the other petitions added really almost nothing. You know, different phrasing, different words. There were no facts that were added.
Does that apply to the shackling claim as well?
Yes, that does.
And did the shackling claim in the pre-AEDPA petitions involve a claim of prejudice at the penalty phase as well as at the guilt phase?
Yes, it did. There was a the one thing that's clear about the shackling claim is that petitioner has consistently argued that the shackling that occurred at the guilt phase was prejudicial both as to guilt and penalty, and the district court found that we goofed and didn't squarely and clearly raise the fact that he was also shackled at the penalty phase. And we have addressed that in our brief and suggested that we should be allowed to go forward.
Are you arguing that he was shackled at the penalty phase or that the guilt phase shackling affected the jury at the penalty phase?
Both. The undisputed evidence shows with respect to the penalty is that, as in Wiggins, the scope of counsel's investigation was unreasonable in light of what they had actually found and discovered in the school records, in the CYA records.
Let me ask you, what do you have that you can direct us to that he was shackled during the penalty phase?
I believe that the California Supreme Court's decision made a finding that he was shackled throughout the trial. We also have a declaration from his sister, Mr. Cox's sister, Adrena Myers, who said that he was wrist-cuffed to the chair. He had a handcuff to the chair on the day she testified. And she testified only in the penalty phase of trial. That was her only appearance in court.
But there's no – the crucial question here is the jury's knowledge of that fact. And I may be mistaken on this, but my reading of it was that the only factual finding is that four jurors observed shackling during the guilt phase, and that there's no finding of any juror so observing during the penalty phase. Am I reading that incorrectly?
I believe you are, Your Honor. I believe the declarations don't just say during the trial, throughout the trial.
What did the district court judge find?
The district court, I believe, held, first of all, that we could not argue that he was shackled at the penalty phase because the district court believed it wasn't squarely presented. And also, I believe that there was no finding on the sister's declaration and no...
Well, she wasn't a juror. The question is, what did the jurors see?
Okay. The jurors saw Mr. Cox shackled during the trial.
During the guilt phase,
is
your argument, or at least that's what I read.
Well, that was the argument as it was limited by the district court.
Okay, but what do we do with the California Supreme Court finding that no juror ever saw any shackling?
That finding was made only on the direct appeal record. That finding was not made with juror declarations and juror interviews. So in post-conviction in state court, when all of the juror declarations were put in front of the court simply denied the claim on its merits.
On a harmless error ground?
No. The court just, it was a summary minute order denial in post-conviction in state court. And the state court findings on the shackling issue are quite clear that the trial court didn't base its findings on any determination of the fact, that it was based solely on rumor and innuendo, that it was insufficient rumor and innuendo no matter who supplied it, whether it was supplied by the defendant's attorney. What the court did say is that the record was rife with an undercurrent of tension and emotion, but it didn't contain a single substantiation of violence or the threat of violence. And those findings were not rebutted at all in the in any of the federal court proceedings. There was no attempt by the state to rebut those findings, and so those went forward presumed correct. In addition to the fact that several jurors saw the shackles in the courtroom...
Well, is there a dispute as to whether he was shackled during the guilt phase?
No, there is no dispute about that.
And you had the same jury.
Yes, and he had the same jury, and they had no reason to believe that he was suddenly unshackled. They were... there's just no... Yeah. Reason to think that what they had seen every single day during the guilt phase didn't change. And that's confirmed by the sister's testimony.
Well, she didn't testify. She didn't declare with respect to what jurors could see. And the witness and the jurors are in different places.
Yes, that is true. But the jurors were very clear that they saw the shackles throughout the trial. The limitation about seeing them only during the guilt phase is not in their declarations.
Even in the Supreme Court's most recent iteration on shackling in the Deck case, the fact of shackling alone does not equate to reversal. There's still a harmless error analysis that's required. And I would appreciate your addressing why this fact would not have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor. One of the harmless error factors we've just covered, which is that the jurors actually see the shackles. The second one is that the court looks at whether the shackles are physically painful, and that is right in the trial record itself, that there are three separate complaints about the painfulness and the distracting nature of the shackling.
How does that have to do with whether the jurors would have voted differently?
Okay, well, let me address that aspect of the prejudice. The shackles clearly painted Mr. Cox as dangerous, as likely to have been violent, as likely to have been the trigger person, which was clearly an issue that they were facing.
Yes, except the evidence on those points was overwhelming. I mean, that's even an understatement. It's hard for me to understand how any jury could have come to any other conclusion regardless of the shackling. I'm
yes.
only speaking for myself, but obviously, I mean, I need to understand from you why you think a jury, given the evidence that was actually presented at both parts of the trial, why a juror might have come to a different conclusion.
Yes, Your Honor. I know that the evidence now, from this perspective, looks like it's overwhelming. But if you look at what the jury did in the penalty phase, once they were presented with the aiding and abetting argument, they were out for 10 hours over 3 days. So however it looks to us now, it looked different to them at the time.
Well, it might just mean they were being awfully careful because this was a hugely important decision. It doesn't mean that it was not an obvious decision, does it?
Well, I think it means a little more than that, Your Honor, because in addition to the 10 hours of deliberations, the jury came back and they wanted to hear the testimony of Neil Alexander and Ivan Scott, and I want to talk about them in a minute, the two eyewitnesses who were in the house. And then they also asked to rehear the testimony of LaShawn Driver and Venus Webb, who were outside. They also asked for photographs of Mr. Cox and Mr. Williams, who couldn't look more different. And then they also asked for a diagram of the house. The evidence that pointed to the fact that Mr. Cox is an aider and abettor is not a tiny piece of evidence. It is a description by the only two true eyewitnesses to the crime that the person who was the shooter on whose back Neil Alexander jumped had a description that of both by appearance, physical appearance, and by clothing that matched the co-defendant Williams.
But didn't the jury reject that argument?
Not really, Your Honor. They, yes, they returned a death verdict, but part of that is owing to how poor the mitigation presentation was. The jurors could have accepted the fact in this case that Mr. Cox was the aider and abettor, but that it was simply not enough, given what else they had to look at the penalty phase, to give him a life verdict. The other thing I need to point out about the way this case was presented in terms of Mr. Cox being the aider and abettor, by saving the aiding and abetting issue for the penalty phase, and by not understanding how the aider and abettor could be guilty of four counts of first-degree murder without intending to kill, the lawyers moved the defense that should have been presented in the guilt phase to the penalty phase.
That was now, part of the strategy of avoiding the death penalty, according to Mr. Cook. And proving intent at the guilt phase, which this is not a certified issue, but proving intent at the guilt phase could be proven by the circumstantial evidence of him walking into the house with his rifle and coming back out and stating what he said. afterwards. I mean, people could infer from that, a rational jury could infer from that, that he had the intent.
Yes, and I actually want to turn a little bit more to the penalty phase prejudice, but let me respond to that. When the California Supreme Court decided the Williams case, the co-defendant's case, one of the comments that the court made was that you could not infer from the crime itself the intent of the person who would be the aider and abettor. And they said there was nothing in the crime itself that suggested anything about the aider and abettor's intent. And the other issue is that the fact that Mr. Cox came out with the rifle is totally consistent with co-defendant Williams having been the actual killer in this case. And he was so identified.
Weren't the bullets that they found in three of the four victims, or four of the five bullets they found, were from the rifle?
Yes. Every single shot was fired by the rifle that Mr. Williams was holding when Neil Alexander jumped on him in the bedroom and knocked the rifle aside. And then Mr. Williams left, and Mr. Cox picked up the rifle, and he left.
Well, if you'll indulge me for a minute, this is what is the troubling question for me in this case. It is clear that this lawyer did a substantial amount of investigation, more than most cases that we have. And it's also clear that he didn't do everything. He didn't have to go through Cox to find out his mother's criminal records or to get the records of the children being taken from the mother, or I guess there were a couple other things he didn't do. On the other hand, his position was he had enough, and he did know about abuse by the mother and other of these issues, that he had enough to make the strategic decision to emphasize the non-shooter theory as the theory of the defense, and at the penalty phase, the theory for life. And so, and our cases say, the Supreme Court has said, you have to do all the available evidence. Now, how was his strategy decision not to pursue everything to the nth degree, how did that harm?
Okay, let me focus, that is kind of a hindsight retrospective view, looking back at the way the case looks now and what counsel left himself with when it was time to do the penalty phase presentation. I want to focus on the four clear red flags or pieces of information about Mr. Cox that no reasonably competent counsel trying a capital case in 1985 would have ignored.
Let me ask you this. When members of his family, when that testimony took place, the jury learned that he was a Boy Scout, and he got some awards, that he was a good athlete, he was a good kid, and he did other things that were good, but the jury never found out about his life and what he went through with his,
yes,
with his mother being a prostitute, and with his trying to kill his sister, and with his mother coming at him with a knife, and with this pimp that she was with, he was, as I recall, was murdered, and how when he went to his grandmother, this is when he's a little kid, his mother started a fire in the house, and it goes on and on and on. The time he spent in juvenile dependency court, and all those records, and there's a whole, you can go on for a half hour talking about the horrible conditions that this young man was raised under, never really saw his father. I don't even think he knew who his father was. And his sister was the daughter of a pimp and his mother. But none of that, he didn't go. Did he go in there and get these juvenile dependency records? Did he get the other records on the mother, all of her convictions?
No, he did not. Yeah. And he knew about those early. Well,
why don't you talk about that?
I just would like her to answer my question, which is slightly different. My question is not should all of that come in.
Yes.
My question is should he have gotten all of that information and then made his strategic decision to go with the non-shooter and not put it in, because there is an argument to be made that, you know, after the mother was gone, he started living with his grandmother. He did have potential at school. He had educators who liked him. He was a good possibility of athletics, right? So the question is, did he have to have all that information before he made the choice?
Well, he had to do some basics. And let me do this. Let me talk for a couple minutes about the three really, really critical red flag indicators and then move to why I think this information was incredibly valuable, and one juror clearly would have voted for life, because the mitigating evidence that would have been developed from this initial set of records that counsel had really breaks down into about five independent mitigation themes. Counsel started okay. He got releases from the client. He talked to the client. He talked to the uncle. He obtained the CYA, the California Youth Authority, and the school records very early on in his representation. The school records say that the client was in foster care. The CYA records say that Mr. Cox was removed from his mother's care at age 5, and she was a child abuser. Why would a reasonably competent counsel in a capital case not want to find out why his client was in foster care, what the extent of the abuse was during the most formative developmental years? As counsel's investigation went on, they learned from other family sources that Mr. Cox was removed from the home. And if they had obtained the records, and they actually learned that he was removed from the home twice, if they had obtained the records, they would have learned that Mr. Cox was known to the Department of Social Services, the family was known since 1965, that his mother was his caretaker for approximately the first 6 years of his life, that she was explosively and uncontrollably violent, she had a history of physical illness and mental instability, and it goes on and on and on and on with incident after incident.
You know, what you're really arguing for is that the strategic choice that counsel made wasn't the right strategic choice, but that seems like second-guessing, because if all of that had been presented, it seems to be at cross-purposes with the idea that he was a basically decent or salvageable kid who wasn't the shooter because Williams, who was a worse guy, was the shooter. I mean, the jury didn't believe that ultimately, but that was the defense theory. And as you pointed out earlier on, it wasn't a foolish theory at all. In fact, you wished he'd started it sooner. And I don't know how those two are compatible and why it was not a reasonable strategic choice.
Let me address the compatibility. Because this is no more a strategic choice than the choice in Wiggins. Counsel had a very rudimentary understanding, developed a theme, went forward, although there were red flags all over that it was contrary. The mitigation, properly presented and properly developed, would not have painted Mr. Cox as a monster. And that was counsel's position that he came to very late in the game, actually, after he was confronted with the fact that they had evidence of abuse and didn't investigate it. He switched up and said, well, it wouldn't have mattered. It would have made him a monster. But the witnesses the counsel would have uncovered would have included junior high school administrators, CYA counselors, elementary school teachers, friends who were not in a gang, including a friend who was then in the Army, and a friend who would have testified that Mr. Cox lectured him and kept him out of the gang because, as Mr. Cox explained, there was nothing the gang could give this kid that his family had not already given him. That is very powerful mitigation. The school teachers and the administrators who counsel did an interview would have talked about Mr. Cox's essential, not a tough and hardened person, someone who was reachable with intervention. The CYA counselor similarly had very positive views of Mr. Cox. He had stepped in to deflect violence away from the staff, which is something that is very difficult to do if you're a CYA ward. So the fact that counsel may have had that theory doesn't square with what the evidence would have showed. And I see that I've gone.
Are you saying that all of this funnels in or factors in to the aiding and abetting issue? Is that your argument?
No, that is not my argument, that this is independent mitigating evidence, but that the aiding and abetting, given what the court, I believe, has characterized as an enormous crime, just from the questions, the aiding and abetting was not going to carry the day in this case. And the extraordinary...
Well, why do you say... Now, that sounds like hindsight to me. Why not? It seems like the jury... They asked for the testimony, the eyewitness identifications, all the evidence about the inconsistent identifications by the two sets of witnesses did come in.
Yes, I understand that. But there were things that needed to be explained. Left unmitigated and unexplained, the fact that Mr. Cox was in a gang and, as counsel argued, that he was dominated is not mitigating. It is not helpful. But if we look at what Dr. Maloney said and what he would have told counsel was that even many capital defendants who have harsh socially and psychologically crippling backgrounds don't have backgrounds that are as extreme as Mr. Cox's. Dr. Maloney believed that the trauma left lifelong scars and warped Mr. Cox's options as a child and as an adolescent, and really explained his gang membership. It is the extraordinary history and trauma and neglect that left Mr. Cox damaged, broken, traumatized by age 12, vulnerable to embracing the trappings of a gang life, and that explained his loyalty and the importance to him of having an alternative family, the gang family, and the pressure that put on him, which in turn explains his involvement in the crime, that even as an aider and abettor, how he could have come to be with Mr. Williams on that day.
And well, you're saying then that that effective argument could have been made had counsel gone in and gotten his CYA records, his dependency records, and gotten all this information on the mother,
yes,
presented to the jury this the picture that this the life that this kid was subjected to, and that somehow they would then conclude he was not an aider and abettor, or he didn't.
No, they would conclude that he should live.
Why don't you say that then?
I thought I had, Your Honor. I'm sorry. They would have concluded that he should live, and one juror would have concluded that he should live.
If they heard all of that, they'd feel very, very sorry for him, and they might decide that he'd suffered enough in life that that he should live, and spend the rest of his life in prison.
Yes, I think they would.
So he wouldn't have been painted as a is a terrible person, and who went in there with a rifle, and had some other testimony here about what he said after, that's in the record, when a certain yes. woman was killed and all that. So they would have felt sorry for him. Just all you need is one juror, and he would have lived.
Yes, sir.
And that's your argument in a nutshell.
In a way, Your Honor.
What do you mean in a way?
I see that I'm out
of... Why do you have to make everything so complicated in life?
Yes, it is a very straightforward argument that one juror would have believed that this person deserved to have a first chance at life.
Yeah, okay.
And I see that I've actually gone over my time and eaten up my rebuttal.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Good morning, Deputy Attorney General Jaime Fuster for respondent. Judge Marshall correctly decided in this case that petitioner is not in death row because of any ineffective assistance of counsel, the use of restraints, or any other error. Petitioner was given the death penalty because of the overwhelming evidence of guilt and the despicable and cold-blooded nature of the crimes he committed. As to petitioner's claims of ineffective assistance, the pertinent inquiry is not what counsel could have done in hindsight or with like decades to investigate the case again, but whether the choices they made at the time were reasonable based on what was known at the time the choices were made. I think the first choice I would like to discuss is counsel's decision to emphasize or raise the possibility that or the doubt that petitioner was not the shooter in the case.
Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. When he made the decision, the attorney at the penalty phase, did he have all this information about the mother and the dependency records and the CYA records and all the rest of this long trying history that this kid went through? Did he know that? Did he have it?
Well, the
I asked you, did he have it?
He did not have everything that has been presented by habeas counsel in the habeas proceedings. Nevertheless,
Did he have the mother's records?
The criminal records of the
yes.
mother? I don't believe so.
You don't believe so? All right. Did he have the kid's dependency court records?
I don't believe so.
Okay. And did he have his CYA records?
Yes, he did. And he also had the school records.
What?
He had the school records and the CYA records, both of them. They also, before they made the strategic decisions for the penalty phase, they interviewed petitioner more than 10 times.
You know, it's always easy to say strategic decisions. You know, you're in the middle of a trial. I don't know. I mean, that people make strategic decisions. That's something the Supreme Court cooked up. And, you know, you get a criminal trial and, you know, all the things that go on. Yeah, maybe you make a decision or you don't. Or you're tired and you don't look at something or you just don't care. And so we can say it's strategic. But he made a decision.
Well, I think the problem in any kind of our case at this point in time, 20-something years after the case, is that we are always looking in hindsight what counsel did and what counsel supposedly should have done.
Well, that's true, but we look in hindsight in a lot of these cases and we find people are not even guilty.
Well, in this case, there is no doubt that.
Well, I'm not saying in this case, but, you know, don't condemn hindsight. Sometimes wisdom comes with hindsight, too.
Well, I think in this case, the important question is that when counsel decided to rely...
It wasn't 30 years, was it?
Well, the case was tried in January of 1986. So it has been...
19 when?
1986. So it has been 23 years since the trial. But the point I wanted to raise is that at the time, counsel decided to rely on the non-shooter theory as opposed to some evidence of abuse. they have interviewed Petitioner more than 10 times. They have interviewed all of those that were closest to Petitioner at the time in 1985 when the case was being investigated. Those who knew him better, including his uncle, Brady Armstrong, both of his parents, his siblings, and his grandmother and his great-grandmother. And the important thing here is that the account that was given by all these family members, including Petitioner, to counsel was a consistent one, one in which his main caretaker in life was the great-grandmother, not the mother. They also learned that the mother was abusive, that she had a criminal record, that she was an addict. They also knew that she lost custody.
Okay, so when they found out about that, why didn't, I mean, wouldn't that lead one reasonably to go get the mother's criminal records?
I think what happened is that because the main consistent account that we're getting is that even if the mother was a horrible person, the great-grandmother was the main caretaker in his life, and she was not abusive. She gave him a stable home. He got to do Cub Scouts. He got to do sports. He got to go to school. And that testimony or that evidence was going to be there no matter what. Even if they could find that earlier in his life, he was abused by his mother. The bottom line in this case, from counsel's standpoint, based on what they knew at the time, is that no matter what the mother did to Petitioner, he was given a stable home for many years before the crimes by his great-grandmother.
All right. Assume that's what the trial counsel decided to emphasize because it lent support to his non-shooter theory. Another area that he didn't look at, which he even noted in his his notes that he should have looked at, was to talk to Cheatham, Ida Moore, and what's the other one? Lisa Brown, Williams, to find out the circumstance. Everybody apparently was high on crack, especially Williams, and Cheatham might have been able to at least talk to him, find out what the circumstances were, what the plan was. I mean, if Williams was, this is consistent with the non-shooter, if Williams was the mastermind, leader, organizer of this attack, isn't it deficient for the trial counsel not to talk to the very people whom could support his theory that would support life instead of death?
Well, the theory was that once Petitioner and Williams were inside the victim's house, there was a doubt as to who was the shooter. Evidence as to who used crack cocaine hours before the shooting or not doesn't really respond or add to who was the shooter inside the house, because I think the pertinent thing here is how...
Well, if Williams was actually really out of it on cocaine, maybe he was a shooter.
But I think the way in which this crime was committed is clearly inconsistent with some kind of random, crazy shooting inside the house.
Oh, it seems so consistent with some crazy, random shooting inside the house.
Well, there were no bullets wasted
in
this
case. Didn't they go to the wrong house? I mean, how'd they end up at this house?
Well, that's because it seems like they have an address in a piece of paper. So clearly this was a premeditated shooting. They were looking for the house based on an address that was written in a piece of paper.
Okay, the counsel's theory was Williams was how many ever years older, and Williams was organizing this whole thing. I suppose that, you know, he should at least have talked to Cheatham and the others to find out, is this true? I mean, was Williams really doing it? Was he the one who was going to shoot? What was the plan? Was Cox just carrying the gun for him to shoot afterwards? Because there was that inconsistent eyewitness testimony inside the house.
But there is no evidence whatsoever, even in no
fashion. Well, I know the point is, should he have developed that evidence? Was that deficient? There isn't, you're right. And
no,
so how come he had written down, interviewed Stanley Cheatham, and he didn't interview him?
Because Stanley Cheatham was not a witness to these crimes. In this case, there was the plan that was...
He was at the house when they were planning this crime.
But there is no evidence, even from Mr. Cheatham's own declaration, that he knew what was going to happen and that he was a party to any discussions
of
the crimes in this case.
Of course he would say that. That would make him an accessory before the fact.
But then we would be just... I mean, They have to show both lack of competence by the counsel and prejudice based on evidence.
Okay, but I'm just talking about competence because this, to me, this is a very close case. Like I said, Cook did a lot of things. He had a lot of people coming in trying to work with Cox. Cox was somewhat uncooperative. He did get a lot of records. He had this theory that maybe he could paint him as some kind of a decent guy in front of the jury, and the jury would opt for life because maybe he could contribute something living in the prison, however horrible the conditions were. To me, that sounds like a somewhat reasonable theory, but then why not investigate everything you could to support that theory?
I think the problem with that position is that the mere fact that Williams may have been using crack and that he's a violent person, that doesn't really show one way or another who was the shooter.
Cox wasn't using it at the time, and Williams was.
Because I think that in this case,
well, we all know using crack cocaine has the propensity, makes some.
Well, we don't know that. That would just be a speculation. Clearly, Williams.
We don't know that Williams. In this case, but we know as a general matter from all the expert stuff that we've read about the use of crack cocaine, that it does have a propensity to make people more violent, right? You don't know that?
It could be, but that's not the type of evidence that was going to convince anybody in this case because of the hard facts about this case. We're not dealing with a case in which they randomly pick somebody and start shooting inside a house. We have a case where they looked for the search for the victim's house. Both Williams and Petitioner went in with weapons. And clearly, one very significant piece of evidence here, Williams had his own handgun. If he suddenly decided that he was going to start shooting people because of some, crazy idea because of his cocaine use, he had his own firearm in his hand.
Let's take the statement that was actually made by either Cox or Williams, somewhat inconsistent testimony on that. Before they entered the house, they were going to shoot this woman. That was their plan. They were going to shoot this woman. They get in, all of a sudden they can leave the house, and it's not just the woman at the kitchen table drinking coffee who they've shot. They've shot up the whole house, including kids in their bed. Doesn't that seem a little?
Well, for people like us, that are reasonable, law-abiding people, that would be normal. But we're dealing here with two hardcore gang members. Cox, Petitioner and Williams were Rolling 60s gang members, and everybody knows who the Rolling 60s are. They were not reasonable people to start with.
See, I don't know who the Rolling 60s are.
But Rolling 60s is one of the most violent gangs in South Central Asia, Crips gang, and they're very violent.
Still true today?
And they're still going on today. And the Rolling 60s, we have to look at this case from the perspective of who the defendant.
So this is a normal thing for the Rolling 60s to go in and shoot kids in their bed?
Well, hopefully not. And I think that's what this case is, a death penalty case. And
I'm wondering why, what something else has to be going on here.
Well, I think I would like just to kind of highlight the facts that cannot be denied in this case. First of all, there was a conspiracy.
The other two that were convicted,
Williams
and the death penalty was reversed, right? On Williams?
Williams.
It was reversed on an instructional error.
What?
It was reversed based on an instructional error as to the special circumstance.
And the other one was got life.
Got life, and he's the one that never went into the house.
How much older than Cox was Williams?
I think Williams may have been around his mid-20s, and Cox was 18. So they were maybe around 5-7 years different, something like that.
And who was the leader?
I think the evidence does show that Williams was the person that was in charge of this hit, this contract killing.
Was it contract killing?
It was a contract killing, and I think there was, aside from what was presented in the case, the defense counseling were well aware of all the discovery that was given to them by the police that show a lot of evidence as to why this happened. It's just that it wasn't presented at the case for whatever reason. The prosecutor decided this wasn't necessary to prove the case. But there was a wealth of evidence given to trial counsel during discovery as to the fact that this was a contract killing, just that they ended up going to the wrong house. Because I think there was probably a difference as to whether it was street versus place or something like that, but they got the wrong street and went to the wrong house because of that.
So
we're not dealing with just some random
But the prosecutor didn't put in the evidence that it was a contract killing?
I think the only evidence that was presented that it was a contract killing was the fact that after the crime, petitioner was able to buy within a couple of hours of the crime a Cadillac for $3,000. And I think that was kind of, but I think the prosecutor decided not to try this whole conspiracy aspect of the case because maybe they were missing one piece of evidence or they were, or it may have confused the jury as to what was going on since they went to the wrong house. But I think the key thing here is that we have an organized criminal action by three people that decided that we're looking for the victims, that went with two weapons inside the house. We're not dealing with something that just, the murders in case, this case were not an act of, of some kind of random crazy action of somebody under the influence of drugs.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you about the shackling issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some discussion about several aspects of it, including what issues were preserved, whether at the guilt phase only or with respect to the penalty phase. And secondly, some factual issues as to when the jurors observed the shackling. And then also your view of whether this is a pre-EDPA claim. Also, and I know that's a lot of questions in one, but I'd just like you to discuss briefly the shackling issue.
As to the, whether this case is covered by the ADPA, I believe the shackling claim was raised in the very beginning before the act was enacted. So our position at this point in time is that it was not covered by the act.
So when you say it was raised, was it raised
in
as opposing counsel states both as to the guilt phase and the penalty phase?
Well, I believe the district court made a finding that the argument was raised only as to the guilt phase. And I think at the time that I read the petitions, I was confused as to whether the claim was being raised as to both phases of trial.
I think the district court was wrong in that. I actually went back and looked, and it's he definitely seems to have always subsumed within the shackling claim that it had an effect during the penalty phase. I mean, I could go back through this with you, but the Third Amendment petition.
I believe that this, what happened in this case, the district court made a finding in the first order that the issue was only raised as to the guilt phase, and also made a factual finding that petitioner was only restrained during the guilt phase.
Right. The question is, you know, I don't know if I would think that the district court's finding that he was shackled only in the guilt phase was error. I don't think that. But if you look at the Third Amendment complaint, the Third Amendment petition at page 19, it says, the trial court's decisions concerning physical restraints violated these principles and had a substantial and injurious effect on the jury's guilt and penalty phase verdicts. So my question is, perhaps the district court did get this wrong. And is there anything to the argument that assume that he Cox was shackled only during guilt phase and assume that four jurors saw him shackled during guilt phase? Why wouldn't that, the impressions and all the things that the Supreme Court has warned us about leading from the shackling, roll over into the penalty phase when it's being decided by the same jury?
I don't disagree with that position. An argument could be made that because the jury saw some restraints during the guilt phase, that fact could have some effect in the penalty phase. In theory, that argument could be raised.
But isn't the, well, I think it was raised. Isn't it then the government's burden of proof to show under DEC that shackling did not affect the juror's view of the penalty phase beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think the burden is on petitioner to show under Brecht that the use of restraints during the guilt phase had a substantial and injurious effect on the penalty phase verdicts. So the burden is not on us. The burden is on petitioner to show, because the Brecht standard imposes.
The Brecht is over DEC? Well, I mean, there would be, when would Deck come into play? Would it be on direct appeal, as you're saying?
I think that's our position. Brecht is the standard for habeas.
Deck was a direct appeal case, right?
Yes. And I think Brecht is the standard for habeas corpus cases that are challenging a state judgment.
Okay. So then the question is, given that the jurors, at least four jurors, saw the shackling during the guilt phase and then also decided the penalty phase, whether that shackling had a substantial injurious effect on their determination, or at least one juror's determination, as to whether Cox should live or die?
The standard is the petitioner has to show that there was this substantial injurious effect as far as the jury's penalty phase verdict, based on seeing this handcuff or seeing the, I think it once during the guilt phase, an ankle chain was used. And I think that as to the issue's prejudice as far as the restraints issue, I think it's very important that this case doesn't involve, like unlike this Spindy Russian case, it doesn't really involve these heavy chains that were really overly visible to the jury. It doesn't or clearly affected the petitioner's ability to sit there in the courtroom. What we have here was mostly the use of a single handcuff that was in his wrist that couldn't be seen by the jury unless the petitioner moved his hand. Also, there was a brace, like a leg brace used, that was inside his pants. Clearly, that was never seen by anybody.
That wasn't that later? I mean, didn't the sequence of events go, there was this rumor that he was going to escape, so they really shackled him up. And that was kind of noticeable. And then over time, they decided that risk was somewhat gone, but they would just keep him shackled only a little bit.
I think what happened in this case, after the court decided to use restraints, what was used first in this case was the handcuff. Then at some point during the proceedings, there was another event in which the bailiff told the court that a petitioner was being unruly or something like that, and they decided to use like an ankle chain just for the one day. Then the following day, the court, on the record, the court explained that the sheriff's department have come up with this like a plastic brace or something like that that went inside his pants, and that's what it was used the following day. So that's kind of the sequence of events. Then trial counsel and petitioner objected to the use of the leg brace, and the court said, all right, we will only use the handcuff. And then at some other point, they may have used the leg brace once again, and that's kind of like the sequence of the restraints that were used.
And what is your view of the evidence with respect to what the jurors saw and when they saw it?
I think just for purposes of the proceedings in the district court, we took the position that even if the jurors saw what they saw as they stated in the declarations, that wasn't prejudicial. So I think what the declarations that were drafted by the habeas team say is that three jurors saw the handcuff or thought they saw the handcuff just based on how petitioner was moving. And one of them supposedly saw two of them supposedly saw the ankle chain once. And that was based on the trial record, that was only used once. So the one day that supposedly the ankle chain was used, 2 jurors saw it, and then three of the jurors saw the handcuff. So that's kind of what the factual allegations that were taken as true by the district court, you know.
Did the handcuff declarations clearly refer only to the guilt phase, or are they ambiguous?
I would say they're ambiguous. There is no specificity there. And they're ambiguous in all respects. They're ambiguous as to exactly what they saw. I mean,
What did he have the handcuff on during the penalty phase also?
Based on the trial record and based on the findings of the district court, you know, the handcuff for any restraint was not used after the last day of the guilt phase.
Okay, so there were no restraints to be seen during the penalty phase.
Well, there is no evidence, aside from the one declaration by petitioner's sister, which in itself is very confusing or ambiguous as to what kind of restraint was the one used, because I think the description that she gives in her declaration is inconsistent with any kind of restraint ever used in this case. So just taking that clearly, the district court, I mean, we have to assume that consider every single piece of evidence that was provided to the court and deny, and in finding that the restraints were not used in the penalty phase, rejected that declaration. So I think that undisputed, let's say the facts that are taken as true for, as far as the restraint claim are that 4 years saw the restraints, that the restraints only involved the handcuff, a leg brace, and once an ankle chain, that these weren't really the type of restraints that will be necessarily a sign of that a petitioner is dangerous. And I think the key fact here is by the time the jury decided the penalty phase, they already have decided that he was a perpetrator, whether as a shooter or as the second person decided has, of horrible murders, murders that were found to be premeditated in the guilt phase. So clearly, the jury, at the time they decided the penalty phase, they knew that a petitioner is a dangerous individual. And the use of restraints, that there were really kind of minimal restraints, were not something that added anything to what they had to decide in this case.
Can you give me the record sites for the juror declarations? I'd just like to look at those again.
You know, I actually made a photocopies of the juror declarations. On a, for example, the declaration by Ventrilla Denise, which was Whitfield at the time of trial, I think. That's in the third volume of the ER, of the Exeter record at number 14.
Let me find it. What's the name again?
The declaration of Ventrilla Denise is, I believe, a page. It's at the third volume of the Exeter record, tab number 14, and it starts at page 13.
There were four of those declarations? There were four of them? Were they all?
Well, there were several declarations, but only as far as the jurors that decided the case, four of them mentioned the use of the mentioned seeing the restraints, actually seeing the restraints. So there are more declarations, but four of them, and this is something that the Judge Marshall found, four of them showed that they saw some restraint.
And they're all found in volume three at tab four?
Well, actually, let me. The only one in volume three is the declaration by Ventrilla Denise, and I think it's because that was.
What is the citation for the other three declarations?
Actually,
if you don't know it now, maybe you could just write it down and give it to the clerk after.
I think in my brief, I probably have cited to.
I'm sure it's in the briefs, but it would still be helpful.
A lot of material here.
Well,
find things is kind of.
I can quickly try to find it here.
But why don't you do that? Give it after the argument.
Yes,
write it down.
I think at my work, you know, my for the most part, my argument in my brief and here too is that we're assuming it's true that these 4 years saw something, saw a handcuff, or saw this one ankle chain for like the one day that was used in this case. And even assuming that as true, petitioner cannot show the requisite prejudice under Brecht. And well, as first of all, obviously as to the guilt phase, since the evidence was overwhelming, and not only overwhelming, but it wasn't disputed, how could it have any effect on the guilt phase? As to the penalty phase, I think the mere use of a handcuff, that is mostly what was used, that could be seen by the jury, since the leg brace was inside the pants.
It conveys the message that he's a dangerous guy.
But the jury necessarily found that he was a dangerous guy by finding him guilty.
And the basis for restraining him initially was, as I recall, his lawyer told the judge that there was some rumor out there that there might be an escape attempt.
That's right. I think his cousin.
His own lawyer did that, right?
Because he had an ethical duty to tell the court something like that.
Yeah, disputing that, yeah. And then the bailiff came and told the juror what was that again? He was acting up?
That he was acting up, that I think there was some kind of situation with his mother, and he reacted to the bailiff because of something that the bailiff may have said to his mother, something like that. That's kind of what.
The bailiff said to his mother.
That's right.
Yeah, bailiffs, it's not uncommon for some of those bailiffs to say things they shouldn't say.
Well, I think we're not disputing in this case. We're going with the California Supreme Court decision that the restraint shouldn't have been used. The issue here is whether petitioner can show prejudice under Brett. That's kind of our position, is that he cannot show prejudice as to either phase of the trial.
Are capital defendants routinely shackled?
That I don't know. I assume that's just a case-by-case basis, and, you know, they have
so
to be.
So it's case-by-case on whether they're a particularly dangerous killer.
I think the defendants are not really shackled based on how bad their crimes are, but, you know, they're probably shackled or restrained based on, you know, whether there's evidence of escape or whether they're misbehaving in the courtroom. So I assume that would be maybe the main reasons why a defendant would be restrained during trial. But I think as far as the prejudice.
When the judge had this information, were there security, extra security out around the courtroom?
I think there were at least two bailiffs, and I think during some of the hearings, there may have been more than that.
They'd have people out in the halls.
That I don't know. Yeah. I think because this case involved, and I think I mentioned this case involved a member of the Roaring Sixties, and I think that created this more sensitive environment to the danger to everybody in the courtroom, because it wasn't just that he would have committed these horrible crimes, it's that he was also a member of the Roaring Sixties, and they were the ones that may have done something to help him in this case. And I think there was some other evidence that I showed that, like, for example, Burns trying to get convinced Cox to take the blame for him, and he would do something about it. And I think so there was something already going on before this trial that created this fear that there could be escape in this case. But as I said, we're not disputing the California Supreme Court finding that the restraints weren't necessary. So I think that's kind of not really that relevant of an issue in this case.
So is Williams still in prison now?
Well, I think he was given 4 terms of 25 years to life, so that's 100 years to life, and he's never going to get out.
And Burns?
And Burns was given 4 counts of first-degree murder. So either Burns or Williams is ever going to get out. And I think it's very significant as far as the prejudice in this case, whether it's the restraint issue or the ineffective assistance issue, that Williams, who was tried as the aider and abettor in this case, nevertheless was given the death penalty. And I think that's, you know, as far as like whether there could have been some evidence as to whether Williams was using drugs or not, I mean, he still got the death penalty.
The prosecutor tried Williams as the aider and abettor?
That's right.
On the theory that Cox was the killer?
That's right. All 3 cases were tried on the same theory. There was no inconsistency. All 3 cases were tried on the theory that the petitioner was the shooter.
And that's because of the rifle, that he was the holder of the rifle, and that the rifle was the
he had the
deadly,
rifle
was
before,
the weapon that killed. He had before
and after,
and the rifle was what killed.
And it was the only murder weapon, and every murder in this case was a direct shot to the head. We're not dealing with, like, some crazy random shooting, but each victim in this case, the grandmother having the cup of coffee in the kitchen was shot 3 times in the head, all 3 shots right in the head. The mother, the daughter of the grandmother, was shot 3 times in the head, well, twice in the head and once in the neck. And the 2 boys in this case were each shot once in the head. So we're talking with very precise shooting with a military rifle. And I think it's very significant ineffective assistance issue that Williams had his own firearm in this case. He didn't need to use the rifle to shoot anybody. And if he was going to suddenly go crazy and start shooting people, he would have used his own handgun. He wouldn't have just said, all right, petitioner, give me your rifle and I'm going to use yours. That would clearly show some kind of intentional and premeditated conduct as opposed to just some. And I think that kind of goes as to why evidence that Williams may have been using crack. And there was no evidence that petitioner ever used any crack, but evidence that Williams used crack wasn't really that significant.
Or the plan, or evidence of the plan, what it was.
Well, the plan also shows that this was a premeditated murder. It shows that they went looking for the victims. They went, both of them entered the house with firearms.
The jury's already found that. So I'm just thinking, well, you know, what did they plan, that Cox would do it or that Williams would do it?
In the way to the house, twice, and while petitioner was still inside the van, twice, there were statements made by the people behind the 2 women that were driving, so they didn't see exactly who said it, but I think one of the times was Williams that said it, that we're going to go and shoot everybody, we're going to go and kill everybody. Those two statements were made in the way to the house. Once the petitioner and Williams left the van and started walking to the house, one of the two women in the van asked Burns, what's going on? What are they doing? And he said something like, they're going to go and shoot it up or something like that. And so he made some kind of statement like that. But while petitioner was inside the van, Williams, the two that actually committed the crimes, they said, we're going to go, somebody there said, we're going to go and kill everybody in the house. And clearly, in this case, the actions speak much louder than any words. I mean, they went without any kind of provocation and shot a whole family. This wasn't something that just suddenly, that something happened during inside, while they were inside the house and they started shooting people. Each of the victims in this case was shot before they even knew what was going on. I mean, three of them were sleeping at the time they were shot. So clearly, in this case, there was no precipitating event that somehow changed the plans that they had. Each victim was killed according to the plan. And that's what, this is one of those cases that nothing trial counsel could have done would have made a difference. And I think he made this reasonable decision that whoever the jury finds to be the shooter in this case has no chance to beat the death penalty, because this is one of those crimes that couldn't be justified somehow or mitigated by anything. Just because he was mistreated by his mother in his early childhood, that's not going to change what he did in this case. It doesn't minimize any moral culpability for killing women and children for money, so he can buy himself a Cadillac. That's the evidence that the jury was looking at when they decided that petitioner should get the death penalty.
Help me, just one last question I have for you. The district court determined on the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at the penalty phase that counsel was not deficient in any respect and that there was no prejudice.
That's right.
That she decided both those things.
She decided both, and I think there may have been some ambiguity or something that she corrected in a subsequent order in response to, I think, petition of motion to reconsider. She said, no, I denied the claim on both prongs, as to both prongs of Strickland, the performance and the prejudice, not just one, not just the performance. It's just that the trial court, well, the Judge Marshall made very specific findings after the performance prong, too.
But she found repeatedly that it wasn't. I mean, what specific thing did she find was deficient? I mean, I read her opinion. I didn't see any.
Well, she didn't find anything.
She found everything reasonable.
Everything was reasonable, but even if somehow some of the evidence provided by, or all the evidence provided by habeas counsel during the habeas proceedings should have been presented, even if that should have been investigated and presented, still there was no prejudice. That's kind of that was the finding of Judge Marshall in this case. I believe, unless the court has any other questions. Actually, I would, if you don't mind, I just have one last point I wanted to make. Two last points. As far as the habeas counsel relied on Dr. Maloney's declaration that was provided, in the habeas proceedings, I think the pertinent point here is that at the time that trial counsel was making his decisions for the penalty phase, Maloney told trial counsel something very different than what he said in those declarations. And also I think it's very significant that at the evidentiary hearing, Dr. Maloney testified that he didn't request any documents, he didn't do anything else in this case, he didn't suggest anything else because he could not render any opinions in this case unless petitioner cooperated with an interview and an evaluation. So I think that's the key point as far as Dr. Maloney is concerned and as far as whether counsel should have investigated more or presented any evidence of any mental impairment, which there was none anyway, at that time. The important point is that their own expert told him, there's nothing I can do in this case, and I'm not going to do anything else because he refuses to be evaluated. And I think he made counsel made a reasonable determination that, first of all, that there is nothing there as far as mental impairment, and second, their own expert is saying there's nothing I can do. So counsel cannot possibly be blamed for following what their own expert told him, especially when counsel had no notice of any mental impairment in this case anyway. So they just decided to retain a mental health expert just, you know, just to go the extra step, but not because they were on notice of anything. So, and my last point is, I think there was some mention by opposing counsel as to the requisite intent to kill, and I think it's very clear in cases like this one where the underlying crimes were tried as premeditated murder as opposed to a felony murder, that the specific intent to kill is not a requirement for the aider and abettor, either as to the underlying crimes or the special circumstance. What prosecution have to prove as far as the special circumstance was the intent to aid in a killing. And I think in this case it's pretty clear that even if petitioner wasn't sure, he intended to aid in the killing because he brought in the weapon into the house and he brought it out too, aside from everything else about this crime. And I think on that last point, I would like to submit on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Recognizing that I am out of time, I'm going to limit my rebuttal to some very quick points. Judge Wardlaw asked if capital defendants are routinely shackled in California. No, they are not, but more importantly, in this case, neither Burns nor Williams was shackled at trial. They had the same gang affiliations. There was even more reason to, if you're looking at the crime, which is incorrect, to shackle one of those two defendants. And in the record before this court are the declarations of counsel for Mr. Burns and counsel for Mr. Williams at trial, explaining that. The level of security in this case included a handheld wand, a metal detector outside before you enter the courtroom, and then bailiffs and uniformed security inside the courtroom. So there was plenty of security. I also want to correct what I believe is a mistake on counsel's part with respect to the law. Yes, the standard is, was there a substantial and injurious, did the error have a substantial and injurious influence or effect on the jury's verdict? But the burden is not on petitioner to show that. This court's case is clear about that, and O'Neill is also clear, that the risk of loss, so to speak, falls on the state. So if this court has any doubt about which way this issue should go on the question of prejudice, the tie goes to petitioner.
What case do you have on that, that's the rule?
I believe it's in O'Neill itself from the U.S. Supreme Court, and I really can't pronounce the last name of
spell it.
Of that case. I will find it because we cited it in our last supplemental brief. Okay, it's O'Neill and it's at 513 U.S. 432. And this court picked up that language in a shackling case, actually, and I think it was Roden versus Roland, and found that the error there was an equipoise, and they found in favor of petitioner. And Roden actually might even have been a pre-AEDPA case, post-AEDPA case. I also want to give the court the citations to the jury declarations about the shackling.
Why don't you just write those down?
Okay.
Fine.
The other things I want to hit on a few very quick points about the penalty phase. First of all, one of the reasons that this was not a strategic decision is counsel said, with respect to the abuse evidence, they put on what they had, they would have wanted more, and they would have put on more. With respect to the issue of prejudice from the penalty phase deficiencies, I neglected to mention, and want to mention it now, that two really important aspects of prejudice are that the rosy picture that was painted of Mr. Cox's upbringing, as the court now knows from the documents we have put in front of the court, was false. And the other point is that the prosecution took the paltry little amount of mitigation that was put on and turned it against Mr. Cox. The prosecutor argued that Mr. Cox had every advantage in life. He had love and discipline from his caretakers. He had monetary advantage. And look what he did. Look what happened. He did the same thing with respect to the school teachers. He argued, and this is all in the, cited in our brief, he argued that Mr. Cox had the intellectual ability, no impediments to using that intellectual ability to succeed in high school, and he essentially said that the women who came in and testified who had taken care of Mr. Cox, as well as the teachers, were also Mr. Cox's victims. He totally turned the evidence against him. With respect to whether there was any evidence concerning Williams's use of crack, Judge Wardlaw zeroed in on this, had Stanley Cheatham been interviewed and testified, he would have testified that he, Cheatham, Ida Moore, and Williams were smoking crack on the night before the offense. And then he, Cheatham, fell into a crack coma. There's also evidence in the record. I'm not going to find the site, but in Lisa Brown's testimony during the guilt phase, counsel elicits from her that they were up all night partying the night before. And that was something that counsel never followed up on.
And the time of the crime was 8 a.m.?
Yes. Yes. And Brown has them being up all night before partying. On the question of...
just to follow that one up. Now, the... Cook said that he couldn't get a hold of Moore or Brown because they were in the witness protection program and were unavailable?
They were not in the witness protection program at all, and I actually don't know where that came from. The other issue is there was no evidence of the contract nature of the killing in Mr. Cox's case, was it or wasn't it, but the evidence that was before the jury was Ida Moore's testimony, and it appears in volume 23 of the excerpt of record, tab 39, pages 143 to 144, where she says that Williams said that he was going to collect a debt from a woman. And that was the testimony. With respect to respondents' point about the fact that Williams had a handgun, obviously there are pieces of evidence that could be argued either way in this case, but that's a jury issue, and what we do know is that the jury who heard that evidence and all the other evidence at the penalty phase wrestled with who was the aider and abettor, so it didn't seem to have affected their assessment of the descriptions that were given by Ivan and Neil, and the fact that Ivan and Neil testified that after Neil Alexander jumped on Williams' back, there were no further shots to be heard coming out of the house, that was the end of the shooting. Both people in the house testified to that.
Didn't Cook testify that Cox's family member said he was the hit person for the gang?
That was one of, it actually, no, I believe that the evidence was that there was a rumor that Mr. Cox had committed 12 murders or something like that, and that yes, of course, in a case like this, we're going to be dealing with rumors, but that's the purpose of discovery. There was nothing that was turned over to them that suggested there was any truth to that, that the prosecutor had any information that anything like that, not even 12, but just let alone a prior violent offense other than the robberies that sent him to CYA, were accurate. And finally, with respect to Dr. Maloney, I think the court's cases on Caro and Wallace and there are two others, that whatever trial counsel's duty is with respect to a mental health professional at the guilt phase, at the penalty phase of trial, the burden is on trial counsel to provide the expert with what he needs to be of assistance in the penalty phase. Counsel never provided Dr. Maloney with school records. never provided him with any of the results of their interviews or any information about Mr. Cox. And it is not true that the expert and trial counsel agreed they could do nothing with Dr. Maloney once Mr. Cox had declined to be interviewed. And in fact, Dr. Maloney said, and counsel Rothstein also said, that she knew and he knew that he could testify and had testified in cases where the client was not accessible for an interview. And frankly, the state does that all the time when they put on a mental health professional to opine something about the defendant. They routinely do not have access, at least not in state court, to the client.
They just do it through a hypothetical.
Yes. And if the court has no further questions, I thank you for giving me the extra time.
All right. We're going to take a brief recess.